The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more questions, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Will Bode.
And I'm Dan Epps. So, Will, I just got done doing a very fun event with a friend of the show, United States District Judge for the District of Kansas, Toby Krause. So that was really cool. He's somebody who used to be the Solicitor General of Kansas and argued two super interesting Supreme Court cases, both of which are in the case books I teach from, Keller versus Kansas, which is a cool case about the constitutionality of eliminating part of the insanity defense, and Kansas versus Glover, a cool Fourth Amendment case about reasonable suspicion. So that was my day so far. Have you done anything interesting today?
I think there's a lot of interesting law out of Kansas. I also just got done with a panel for our admitted students about why they should come to the University of Chicago rather than all their other options. Hopefully I convinced them.
And what's the answer? To learn jurisdiction from you?
The answer is that they have lots of professors who are interested in them, want to do interesting things. Students did ask a lot about grades because, you know, a lot of other law schools.
Oh, you have the super weird grading system.
Well, we have a grading system, which sets us apart from all the law schools.
Yes. So
grade you on the check plus standard.
Great effort, you know.
Yeah. So we try to explain why grades are good, but also, you know, not as scary as they seem.
Yeah. We have grades. We have traditional grades here, like A plus and so forth. I mean, you guys have weird numbers. But yeah, that is a real grading system, unlike.
Right. We grade people on a scale from 164 to 186,
which is very arbitrary.
It used to be 64 to 86, and then that looked too much like it might be out of 100.
But that's also deeply arbitrary. Like, where did those numbers come from?
Well, we added the ones.
No, but where did the original numbers come from? That's also weird, right? Why is 86 the highest? Yeah, 86 what? 80, what are the units?
Grades.
Yeah, where is just, I think the idea must have been at Chicago that the best anyone could ever hope to do was like basically a B+, because they could never reach the lofty heights of the Chicago faculty. And so that's the top grade. Is that basically 86 out of 100?
I know. I think even the faculty, there are many people who went here and then are on the faculty. So it's more reserved for, you know, the ghost of Ronald Coase and David Curry or something. Okay.
Well, admitted students, go to Chicago if you want to be graded on a weird grading system.
Or learn about jurisdiction.
Yeah. What can they learn about from me?
What do you teach them, Dan?
I teach criminal procedure. Both the criminal procedure courses. I'm teaching criminal law right now, but I teach con law next year just to switch things up.
Good.
You've been pitching me on your casebook to get those, you know, that extra $20 of royalties.
They send you a copy yet?
Yeah, I've got yours. I've got all the biggies behind me on the shelf. So I'm going to work through those at some point.
Cool.
Okay. So various things to talk about. No, like one biggie to talk about. They didn't give us some huge opinion. So we're going to kind of put together some pieces that we think add up to an interesting discussion. First one maybe is to revisit a case from last time, which is Cruz versus Arizona.
Yeah. I feel bad about this because we talked about this on the episode, on our last episode, right? This is the case about Arizona Rule of Criminal Procedure 32.1G. where the Supreme Court held the Arizona court's interpretation of its own rule was not a so-called adequate and independent state ground, got into this capital case, you know, sort of procedural argument that the state had maybe done something wrong in interpreting its own law.
To deny death row inmate the chance to make a federal law argument in that procedural context.
Exactly. I'm struggling even now to say exactly how to describe the case because despite us talking about it for a while and puzzling over some parts of it, I fear it's even worse than we said. So I may have to sort of regret some things I said last episode.
No regrets.
Well,
yeah.
I might have said it was just the Sotomayor's best opinion ever.
Well, yeah, you might have to walk that back. Well, it depends on your pre-existing conception of her opinions. But so I'm going to set it up and you're going to lay it out, which is basically you have decided and I think you've convinced me that there's like a serious problem with what they did here and it actually doesn't make any sense. And no one seems to have acknowledged that it makes no sense, including us, but including all nine justices and everybody else in the world. And so I was pretty persuaded. I tried to kind of throw some arguments at you about like why maybe you're wrong, but so far I don't think either of us have landed on anything. So why don't you say, what is this problem?
Yeah. And before I do, I have to give one piece of credit. Not quite nobody in the world. So there was an amicus brief in the case filed by Jonathan Mitchell and Adam Mortara, favorite team of legal geniuses, who did have a footnote in their brief saying, basically, if the court was contemplating doing the following bizarre thing, that would make no freaking sense. And it's the thing that the court then did. So now, maybe they didn't read footnote 11. Maybe they didn't care. Okay. So here's the thing. The adequate and independent state ground doctrine, the doctrine that the court used in Cruz for ignoring state procedural rulings, is a threshold doctrine. The idea is once you say something is an adequate and independent state ground, that means that a federal court gets to decide the federal issue.
And so usually it starts out as a rule about the Supreme Court's jurisdiction to review federal issues. It also is used in habeas proceedings, right?
Federal habeas court's jurisdiction to review a state issue. Either way, a federal court starts with it to say.
Yeah. I thought it was not a jurisdictional rule for habeas courts. I thought it was kind of a rule of comedy.
Jurisdiction is a word of many meanings, as we'll talk about later. Yeah. But either way, it's a threshold issue about the court's ability to reach the federal law.
So the state court said, you know, here's some reason why we don't have to reach the federal issue, or here's some, maybe they reached the federal issue, but here's something else under state law that would support the judgment. And so it would make deciding the federal issue kind of meaningless, pointless.
Classic example of one of these, you know, is if the court, again, has some weird and ticky-tacky procedural requirement, says, well, we're not going to reach your big constitutional challenge to your death sentence because your appeal was not filed on red paper. Sometimes the court can say, well, look, we don't care whether it's filed in the red paper or not. We're gonna reach it. So normally it's supposed to be like part one of the opinion. It's supposed to be part one. This is not an adequate ground. Now let's get to part two. And what the court did in Cruz versus Arizona is it wrote part one of that part two.
Yeah, because the court does not decide the underlying federal constitutional issue at all.
At all. And this is weird. I guess two ways to say a little bit about why this is weird. So one is calling something not an adequate independent state ground does not mean that the state court sort of did something wrong. Like the whole point of the doctrine is it's a little softer than say, the state violated the due process clause by like making stuff up, right?
Yeah. Which is a thing that they do sometimes, right? They said, you know, changing the law here is a due process violation, but that's not exactly what this is.
Right. Yeah. There are cases where they do that. They might do that in a different context in the, you know, elections clause in Moore versus Harper, judicial takings cases, but it's not that. It's more like a rule that like we have jurisdiction, again, whether it's jurisdictional or not. Opinion is more analogous to, imagine a Supreme Court opinion on appeal from the Arizona Supreme Court, where the part one of the opinion is, we have appellate jurisdiction. And then part two is, all right, we remand.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, we got here. Yeah. And then where do we go?
Yeah.
And in particular, the question is like, what is the Arizona Supreme Court supposed to do on remand? Yeah. Is there anything stopping them from saying, look, it's very interesting to know you guys don't think our interpretation of state law is adequate to defeat federal review. So y'all are free to review it if you want to. But we think it's adequate for purposes of state law, which is what we decide. So we're just reinstating the verdict. So far as I understand the law, nothing would stop the Arizona Supreme Court from doing that on remand. They wouldn't be doing anything wrong. They wouldn't be being obstreperous. They would just be following what they're supposed to do. And this is what we talked about too. I don't know if the Supreme Court knows that. Maybe they do.
Why didn't somebody say that?
So the parties were trying to raise bigger arguments, right? So the parties, the challengers for Cruz, were going further and saying, not only is the Arizona rule not an adequate independent state ground, but it violates the Constitution. It violates the Supremacy Clause under this previous case, Montgomery. They're making the kind of arguments we were just alluding to. And if that's the argument, then the Arizona Supreme Court on remand would be required to consider the merits. But the court didn't go there. Now, the court did sort of give us all warning of this in that they actually explicitly narrowed the question presented to this adequate independent state ground issue only, which I think probably confused the parties because they were all trying to figure out how to. And so the merits briefs kind of try to blend these issues together. Here's one guess. So, well, here are two guesses, I guess. No, wait, three guesses. I need three guesses. All right.
Okay. Dude, lay them on me.
All right. So one guess is the court knows full well that the Arizona Supreme Court doesn't have to do anything different on remand, but, you know, they just sort of hope that once they get the remand and have sort of like heard what the court thinks, they'll reconsider anyway. Sort of like a gently reconsidered doctrine.
Yeah,
it's a hint. You know, the court sometimes does this a little different when like somebody shows up to the court and like, you know, now suddenly somebody has changed their minds and the court will sort of like remand or GVR in light of something that's like not strictly relevant, but you kind of hope the lower court will get the hint.
Yeah.
Option two is they are planning to change how the AISG doctrine works and turn it more into the due process clause and say,
I don't think they're going to do that.
Even a state court cannot use an AISG to defeat a federal claim. They've got to go to the merits.
That doesn't make any sense. They would have had to say so, don't you think?
Yeah, well. And then option three is some members of the majority wanted to go further. They wanted to decide this on kind of constitutional due process Montgomery grounds, but they couldn't get everybody to join it.
Yeah.
That seemed too radical.
And so they did this incoherent thing.
And so then people said, well, if you decided only on AISG grounds, I could join.
Yeah.
And either not everybody understood why that would be incoherent, or some people understood but didn't feel like they could do anything about it. Like, I mean, you can imagine being a law clerk on the majority, and you're told, like, look, Justice Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts say they'll only join if you say it's AISG only. And you can imagine thinking, like, what the hell does that mean? But figuring better to be in the majority than not. I don't know if that's what happened, but something weird happened. And if the Arizona Supreme Court sticks to its guns, then something really weird's going to happen. You know, presumably people will go back to the Supreme Court and say, is this really what you wanted? And the court will have to figure out what they were thinking.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't have a great solution to that. And I think it's very, very odd. But it may just be mooted when the state court is like, okay, I see they want us to reach this issue. We'll reach the issue.
Right. They could reach the issue. And to be clear, they could reach the issue and still rule against Mr. Cruz. Like, they're fine. We'll reach the issue. And when you get to the facts and the harmless error or whatever, they could decide on the merits. And then it could be we'll never hear about this case again until the next AISG case where people try to figure out, you know, what the doctrine is.
Can I ask a question that's non-substantive about this? So I was pulling up the opinion again. This case came out. We're recording at the end of March. This came out at the end of February. And they've already put it in like a preliminary page proof for the volume 598 of the United States Reporter.
Yeah.
Didn't that used to take like years?
Yeah.
So what's going on?
This is a new change just announced this year, as they now put the preliminary page prints for the U.S. report on their website right away. I think because it used to be they'd kind of, I mean, they know what order the opinions come in. They know how pages work.
Yeah.
So it used to be
years and years.
Well, years and years to make them public, I think, and years and years to do it. No, you're right. Anyway, this is a new change. They've been posting them. It'll make it much easier to cite.
Yes.
Of great relevance to law professors is when you want to cite a Supreme Court case in the past year or two, it used to be you always had to cite it using the Supreme Court page numbers, which then didn't transfer to whatever the U.S. Page numbers would be later. And now we can get straight earlier.
So that's good news, I guess, for somebody. I don't think there's anything else to say about that other than maybe someone will clarify this, but probably not. We probably will. We'll never get clarification on why they did what they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just think that if people understood what was going on, Justice Barrett would have said something about it in her opinion.
Well, it's, I mean, again, you might worry that if you say something about it, they'll say, oh yeah, we are converting AISG into this even more, you know, robust constitutional doctrine.
I don't believe that they would do that, though. I don't believe that in the majority there you have Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh. I don't know if they believe that.
Well, I mean, I'm really not sure.
Yeah. Okay. What else have we got?
One other minor update. I don't know if we need to say anything about it, but I think the Moore versus Harper letters are in. We also talked last episode about how the court had divided the parties to discuss whether the North Carolina Supreme Court's grant of rehearing in the Elections Clause case now makes the decision non-final at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And all the parties have poured in their letters. As you predicted, you know, they don't all come out on the same side. I think Neil Katyal and the chief respondents think the court still has jurisdiction. The United States says, we think the court doesn't have jurisdiction, but frankly, it's not controlled by an existing precedent, and we don't really know.
Yeah, they sort of say probably not, or like they say like it's a kind of hard to say there's jurisdiction. It's a little weaselly.
I think their view is something like, we don't think you have jurisdiction. That said, you don't definitely not have jurisdiction. And here are some theories under which you might have jurisdiction if you were curious. Yeah.
I think it's kind of one of these like credibility building exercises that the SG's office is doing there. They're trying to sort of not come in too guns blazing, even though I'm sure the administration has a strong view about the case.
I sort of think this is the same. I read a slightly sadder version of this. It was like, we don't think you have jurisdiction, but we worry you're going to get mad at us if we tell you you don't have jurisdiction.
Sort of what I was saying.
Yeah. You can have jurisdiction if you want. It's okay. We don't really care. And my favorite was one of the bios, which was very short, that just said, look, we didn't think you had jurisdiction in the first place. We raised all these finality issues in the bio, and we still think we were right.
In the jurisdictional statement or the opposition, whatever those things are called. Yeah, there's two that are that are quite short. The letters by the North Carolina League of Conservation Voters and the letter on behalf of the Harper respondents. I don't know which ones are those, the named ones. Basically, there's two other respondents who choose to write very short letters, including one that sort of says, yep, the answer is still no, but we don't really need to say more about it, which is an interesting strategy, right? We're not going to use this opportunity to dig in and make more of an argument. We're just going to kind of rest on what we said already.
Well, I think that's a little bit of a I told you so quality. Yeah. Like, we said don't get into this because it's not final. And look, haven't events proven us right?
Yeah. But then respondent Common Cause, represented by frequent flyer Katyal, writes the longest letter of them all, saying, yes, there's still jurisdiction, but doing so in order to encourage the court to get in there, decide the issue now, and decide it, you know, against the independent state legislature theory.
Yeah. So I don't really know what to make of this. We don't have to talk about it very much. I had two thoughts. So one, there was an oral argument in the North Carolina Supreme Court on some of the remand proceedings in this period that I watched part of and did find very clarifying, in which both some of the lawyers and justices expressed the view that the court had granted a rehearing on the precedent of Harper 1, the decision under review, but not on the judgment.
Yeah. I don't really know what that means, a rehearing.
Well, it's easy if the cases were not both named Harper.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's easy to imagine if, you know, we affirm one person's conviction, it's final. And another person comes along and says, I'm similarly situated, but he's going to be screwed because his decision is final, but you should now, you know, adopt a different rule for me. It's a little weirder when they actually are in the same case. So I don't know if that works, but at least that theory helped me understand a theory of what could be going on here. I started trying to make my own view, and then I realized I don't even understand how these exceptions to finality are okay and where they come from and whether I should have some sort of originalist take that like all of the Cox factors are invalid. Yeah. And so I just,
you haven't done the big grand theory yet. So
yeah,
I read them all and I actually kind of came down in thinking that there's probably still jurisdiction for the reasons you just said, that there's, you know, there's a separate judgment and the court may be considering this kind of related case, but it's not exactly the same case. It's not the same judgment to reconsider the legal holding, but that's not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. I'm looking forward to seeing how they weasel out of this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it just sort of depends on, do we see this as something where they're looking for a way out, or are they just genuinely curious?
I feel like you don't ask for letter briefs if you're just kind of curious.
Well, you might be genuinely curious, but still inclined to say it's probably okay.
Yeah, that's true. I do think it's good the court did this. I think they should do this more in general. I think there should be more of these kinds of supplemental orders, because sometimes, you know, a complicated issue comes up that you didn't realize how important it was, that argument, and you're going to have to say something about it that could potentially screw up the law of jurisdiction. Yeah. So it's good they asked.
Okay, so those are worth looking at. They're all mostly pretty short. Longest is 10 pages. Okay, we're really kind of speeding through our list of stuff to talk about. Do we have anything like random news we should throw in so we don't, like, you know,
accidentally produce an hour-long episode?
Yeah, our episodes are all too long, and I feel like we need to kind of stick with precedent here.
Well, should we have some sort of 20-minute digression about the best kind of watch?
We could do that. We could go back to Star Wars. Just something to really, really annoy frequent listeners like Kenneth Shamingham, who is also a Kansan. His name came up in my discussion with Judge Krause, famous Kansans who have argued before the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
It's a Kansan, right? That's the right adjective. It's not like a Kansanian or something. Kansation. Okay. And yeah, I don't write. I was hoping that there would be more stuff than that to talk about.
Oh, we haven't talked about Munsingwear yet.
Well, yeah, no, that's going to be good. Justice O'Connor was named Woman of the Year by USA Today. Not sure why this is the year.
Have they never done that before? Yeah, she seems.
Yeah, she seems like she's a big deal. First woman in the Supreme Court. Maybe she should have gotten it earlier. I don't really know how important an award that is, but she got it.
I've never gotten it.
And you never will. But you did get to do the Scalia lecture at Harvard Law School.
That's true.
Which we've kind of, you know, skirted around, but maybe we should talk about it more at length because it was quite interesting, but not today. Anything else? Any kind of like, usually they give us some kind of like gossipy thing to talk about. But I don't really think we've got anything great like that. Yeah, and I mean, I will say they really are kind of, they're not giving us a lot in terms of opinions. They're being pretty slow, which means that it's going to be kind of a busier spring / early summer for us, for better or for worse.
Unless they find a lack of jurisdiction in all the cases.
That would make our lives easier. It would limit. I guess we'd still have a lot to talk about because we'd have to talk about, in each case, why there was no jurisdiction. And then you'd have some theory for why they got the jurisdictional thing wrong that might persuade me. So I guess we should do a few shadow docket opinions.
Yeah.
Is that where we should go next?
Yeah.
Do we still have to call it the shadow docket, or is it just like the orders list or something?
It's fine with me if we call it the orders list.
No. Yeah, that was going to be the first name of your article before
you
were persuaded. So maybe, I guess, going in chronological order, we have one, City of Ocala versus Rojas. And this one is interesting because it is somewhat of a disagreement on how to dispose of a cert petition between Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, who in some ways are the most similar justices on the court, but then in a lot of cases seem to end up disagreeing about a lot of things. And this is a case involving an Establishment Clause challenge. And if you were looking to kind of dial back Establishment Clause jurisprudence, these are pretty good facts for doing so. There was this terrible shooting spree in Ocala, and then the community, you know, got together with law enforcement to hold like a prayer vigil for the victims. And then some atheists came and were offended by it and filed suit. So in terms of a vehicle, not the best vehicle for kind of, I'd say, for pro-establishment clause folks. But the specific dispute here that the court and the two justices are interested in is standing. Right? Can you explain the problem, the potential problem?
Yeah. So the question is that the complaint that the plaintiff had in this case is that she went to a prayer vigil and she didn't like that it was a prayer vigil.
Yeah.
I mean, and that it's unconstitutional if it's a prayer vigil. So she has a point maybe on the merit or a merits claim. But there is something in a lot of areas of the law, understanding doctrine, A, the fact that you don't like something is not necessarily enough to have the injury the court thinks you need to sue. And B, if you went and did it to yourself, it's especially not obvious that you have the interest to sue. And so many cases, we demand a sort of more concrete injury for letting you sue. Now, the puzzle is the Establishment Clause is about, like, in many cases, it's easy to figure out what injury you'd need because you sort of look at the nature of the right, right? So somebody threatened to punish you or did punish you for speaking. Okay, that's standard to bring a free speech claim.
That's kind of like a coercion test, which is one theory.
Yeah. Somebody some way punished you for praying or engaging in some other aspect of your religious practice. Okay, that's standing to bring a fair exercise claim. But the Establishment Clause is not exactly like that. Like, by hypothesis, it bans some things that don't involve the government making you do something. It's sort of confusing to think about what kind of standing would we demand there.
Isn't there disagreement about that? Don't that some folks think it should be limited to kind of places where you're coerced into kind of accepting?
Well, yeah, so that's the ultimate question here. So in this case, there's been a lot of change in the court's view of the merits of the Establishment Clause already. The court thinks a lot more sort of non-coercive monuments and other government observances of religion are constitutional than used to be. But there's still some set of them that are, under current doctrine anyway, some set of them that are unconstitutional. And I think there's nobody in the court who thinks the Congress could pass a law that just says, you know, Christianity is hereby the official religion of the United States. But there's nothing more. Like, nothing is entailed by that. It's just like, there it is.
So you said there's nobody who thinks they can do that? Or nobody who thinks that you can sue to challenge that?
Well, maybe that's the problem. Nobody thinks you can do that, but Justice Gorsuch might be suggesting, Justice Thomas might be suggesting, not totally clear who could sue to challenge that.
Yeah.
And that's the puzzle. So it's sort of bound up with the merits, but it's also sort of bound up with these broader jurisdictional questions. And I think all that Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch disagree about is, should we get into this issue now or should we get into it later?
Yeah.
And you know, Justice Thomas says, all right, let's get into this question of whether, you know, people who are offended by Establishment Clause violations can sue about them. And Justice Gorsuch says, well, you know, the 11th Circuit will probably fix it.
Yeah. Which is interesting. He typically, you know, seems like he's more on the Justice Thomas side. Let's get into it, right? He writes a number of dissents from denial, things like that. Seems like eager to resolve stuff. But yeah, he sort of seems to think, you know, this is going to be worked out. We don't really need to worry about it. But like, why wouldn't he want to just take the case and kind of just, you know, take the axe to this theory of standing?
maybe he doesn't have the votes to take the case anyway.
Well,
sometimes yeah. I think there are justices who, in truth, would be happy to take it now, but there aren't 4 votes for it, so they write about why we don't need to take it now.
So they kind of like pretend that they agree.
Yeah, or they could go either way, maybe. Yeah. But I will say this is also an issue where you might think it would benefit from more lower courts grappling with this. Like the courts, now that the court has said some things about the merits of the Establishment Clause in a recent Gorsuch opinion, Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, you might think, let's get some smart courts of appeals judges thinking through the standing problem first before we weigh in, just so they can give us more to work with.
Yep. I don't know. That's maybe, I don't know how much that actually ends up helping.
Yeah, me neither. And maybe they just feel like they have too many cases. You know, they have like 30 or 40 cases or something.
Yeah.
That's a joke because they have very few cases for listeners who don't know that.
They're not working super hard, but I guess the fewer the cases, the more time they spend wasting on the small number of opinions they have. So I think that was maybe like the least interesting one because it's really, really boils down to kind of a disagreement about take it now versus take it later.
I agree.
Next one, it's either like much more interesting or like deeply boring, depending on what kind of stuff you find interesting. I think hopefully for listeners of the show, more interesting. It's an issue that I've talked about at various points, which is the Munsingware Doctrine, which is a doctrine about when there's a situation where there's a lower court opinion sort of around there, and then something happens before it gets all the way to the Supreme Court, and there's a possibility for it to be vacated, reversed, something like that. There's something moots the case. Under some circumstances, the court will still say, okay, we will kind of as a courtesy, we'll give you an order vacating it under Munsingware just to kind of strip the case below of any kind of precedential value because it evaded review.
Yeah. You can think the original case that's the most stark, right, is like, I sue you, I maybe erroneously win somehow, and then also somehow I'm going to be able to have my cake and eat it too. I'll get my victory against you, but then also I've stopped doing the thing you were upset about. And so
you mooted it, and so the court can't resolve it.
Right.
And if we don't have this, there might be like, let's say, a circuit precedent that would establish your victory that you could use in future cases just sitting there. And the Supreme Court never got to clarify whether it was right or wrong.
Yeah, well, this is something I was not sure about is I think one set of Munsingware cases might also be concerned even about the judgment.
Yeah.
Like you'd be concerned about issues of preclusion or something.
Yeah.
Maybe the right version is I sue you and you win, you the defendant win. And then you announce you're not going to do it anymore anyway, so I can't appeal. And so simultaneously, you have this judgment saying you're right, you have a right to do what you were doing before, but also I can't overturn it. If you had done the same thing before judgment, like in the middle of the case, you stopped doing the thing I'm accused of, we have a special doctrine to say that doesn't moot the case because you can't, it's called the voluntary cessation doctrine, you like can't moot the case by voluntarily ceasing. But if you somehow like do it after judgment, then you can kind of pull the same trick in like the appellate chain. So you can imagine the core case would be worried about the judgment. But the thing that we care about now a lot of the time is, yeah, the circuit precedent. Yeah. We're sort of all spent a lot of time litigating the doctrine of the Eighth Circuit on something, and the Supreme Court won't be able to get involved.
Yeah. And so here, this was an abortion case that arose before Dobbs, right?
Yeah.
And so you have a plaintiff who is challenging the petitioner's denial, who is the petitioner was a clerk, denial of a judicial bypass for an abortion. Mm-hmm. This was a situation, abortion without parental notification. There was a procedure that kind of allowed this to happen. Challenging this is inconsistent with the court's abortion jurisprudence. Okay. It goes up to the Eighth Circuit. Eighth Circuit says the defendant, the clerk, doesn't have quasi-judicial and qualified immunity. So the suit can go forward. It's not barred by immunity, but then Dobbs happens and it makes all this, you know, the underlying legal issue irrelevant. And then the parties get together and say, let's let's just agree to dismiss this. Everybody acknowledges that that makes the case totally moot, right?
Yes. But the question is, what should we do with the lower court opinion?
Yes.
Right. And I think the wrinkle here, is this the weird thing about it, is that the parties also agreed that they would both tell the court that they think it should be vacated under Munsingware.
Yes.
That might have even been part of the deal. I'm not sure. There's some suggestion of that in the separate opinion by Justice Jackson we're talking about in a sec. But in any case, the parties say, look, we've agreed. Wipe the Eighth Circuit precedent off the books. We don't need to worry about this anymore.
Yeah.
But that's not the normal situation where one side is maybe engaging in some sort of unfair trickery to defeat appellate review, right? Like both sides agreed not to have appellate review. Both sides settled the case.
Or just something else happens. I first encountered this issue in a case called Harper versus Poway Unified School District, where there was a student who was challenging the school's refusal to let him where a t-shirt objecting to the school's kind of gay pride, you know, it's not a gay pride day, but that basic idea. And then it went up to, you know, the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit rejected the student's claim in a very aggressive and expansive First Amendment opinion. Student graduated. The case now is moot in terms of any kind of request for injunctive relief. But there's this quite aggressive opinion by Judge Reinhardt floating around. In that situation, the court Munsingwares it to take that opinion off the books.
Okay, so three things here. So one, in a sense, I think this is bizarre. Because in a sense, I think the court will sometimes tell us, like, we review judgments, not opinions. There's all sorts of stuff floating around there on circuit court opinions that isn't necessarily nationwide binding law until the Supreme Court says so. And in theory, you know, nothing stops the Supreme Court from reviewing this issue whenever it comes up again in a real case. On the other hand, obviously the Supreme Court does care about the fact that there are sort of things floating around in opinions that things are wrong. And Munsingwares, these kinds of things sort of feel like they have a little bit of a compromise feel slash an Alexander Bickel feel to me. It's like the court might think about trying to find some way in some of these cases, maybe you couldn't do it here, but some of these cases to like rushing in and taking the case anyway and finding some reason to say it's not moot and like, get, you know, somehow getting into it. And so to stop them from doing that, to sort of like step back from temptation, will say, well, acknowledge the case is moot, but you get to get rid of it.
Yeah. And the court has sort of said, look, you know, we don't do this very much, but we have this dissent from the court's one sentence, two sentence order, three sentence order, if you count the citation, granting Munsingwares relief. We have a multiple page dissent by Justice Jackson who says, basically, look, we're doing this a lot. We used to say this was like kind of extraordinary. We should only do it very, very rarely, but we seem to now be doing it kind of a lot. And it doesn't really make sense here where the party seeking the relief like agreed to dismiss the case and make it moot.
Mm-hmm. Well, so she doesn't, there's a new article that she does not cite, but must have read by Elisa Tucker and Michael Risch, forthcoming in the Florida Law Review, Precedent Unbound, the Supreme Court's Summary Elimination of Liberal Lower Court Rulings, that sort of documents this trend and says, since 2017, the court has vacated as many cases as it did between 1994 and 2016. So the past 6 years has been, you know, as many as like the 18 years before that, basically.
In the same way that there's been an uptick in certain other kinds of shadow docket type things.
Yes, whether it matches exactly. But so it's maybe part of the general trend of the Supreme Court issuing fewer merits opinions and more non-merits shadow docket stuff. And that's interesting. The substitution from merits cases to the shadow docket in general, as we've talked about, is complicated, right? Sometimes you might think, like, Justice Jackson, would you really be happy if the court were just filling up its docket with more Dobbs and Bruin and Kennedy and students for fair admissions and, you know, so on? But I take the point that there's something a little weird about these kind of, this is like a non-transparent, maybe not totally lawful way to shoot down opinions you don't like.
Yeah, and it does seem like we don't necessarily have clear guidance or clear statement from the court about this is exactly when we will do this and this is when we will not do this.
Yeah.
That it's somewhat like all other exercises of certiorari, it's discretionary.
Well, it's discretionary in general, and then the court has said that the sort of this decision about vacator is what it calls equitable.
Yeah. So it's doubly discretionary.
Right, exactly. So it has a lot of play in the joints. Yeah, I've kind of wondered about this too, and I've wondered whether maybe it shouldn't be a thing, or maybe we should do it only for the judgment. We should Munsingwares the judgments to avoid like...
Yeah, like a case where the party would be bound by some judgment that became moot sort of between the judgment being entered and then getting all the way to the court. That seems reasonable.
Yeah, but the circuit court precedent, if the Eighth Circuit doesn't like it, they can reconsider it en banc. If the Supreme Court doesn't like it, they can reconsider it in a case where it matters. I mean, I guess maybe the problem is the Eighth Circuit also couldn't reconsider the precedent.
But then who cares, right? It only matters... Right. If a case comes up again, right?
Yeah. Right. Now, the only thing I wonder is different about this case is the fact that there are these qualified immunity issues at play, because qualified immunity is one of the rare areas where judicial opinions themselves have almost judgment like status, because the approach to qualified immunity, which I don't totally endorse, is if there's an opinion on the merits saying that such and such conduct is not immunized or is unconstitutional, that can put you on notice for the next case. There's a whole Supreme Court case, Camretta versus Green, where the court suspends the normal rules of mootness because qualified immunity opinions kind of work this way. So I couldn't pierce through enough to the details to figure out if that's part of justification for this one.
They don't tell us, right? another situation where they don't tell us why they're doing that. But I guess eight of them agree, or at least don't disagree super strongly, that this is okay here, because this is a solo dissent. Doesn't mean everybody else agreed to do it, but some people might have, you know, voted against it, but then not cared.
Yes, indeed. I'll just say, on the meta point, this is an interesting issue for Justice Jackson to take a stand on. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of shows some reins. It shows she's like digging into the kind of nerdy jurisdictional type Supreme Court practice stuff.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't, you know, she's not somebody who had spent a decade in the SG's office kind of doing those kind of cases. So it shows that she's someone who either, you know, was kind of paying attention to this stuff behind the scenes or has gotten up to speed really quickly. And either way, that speaks very well of her.
Yeah, I agree.
Another one that is, I think, also pretty interesting and maybe more broadly interesting than that one, not just to Fed Courts nerds, which is Danziger versus the United States. Now, this arises out of a really big and long-running legal dispute, which is about what Texaco, now Chevron, did in Ecuador many years ago. Sort of the allegation is that they caused a huge amount of pollution there. And there's been this really long-running litigation involving Ecuador and people in Ecuador versus what's now Chevron. And it's like bounced back and forth. It starts out in the U.S. and then goes down to Ecuador. Ecuadorian courts like issue a judgment for like billions of dollars. And then there's been various legal maneuverings back in the U.S. to kind of weasel out of that. That's the big overarching background, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, this case has been going on for decades now.
Yeah. I mean, I remember this was a hot case when I was in law school. And, you know, we would follow the latest.
It wasn't new. It wasn't new then either.
Right.
So it's just been, there's been stuff going on for a long time, I think. And, but this is not exactly that case. This is a case that arises out of that case.
Right. Right. So one of the more interesting pieces of drama that emerges from this is a lawyer, Steve Danziger, the plaintiff's lawyer, Harvard Law grad, I think, at some point in this gets held in contempt by the district court in New York, right? For the district court believes is his refusal to comply with all of its orders. You know,
they wanted him to turn over his electronic devices and various other things.
Yeah, well, having won this gigantic judgment in Ecuador, yeah, there are all these questions, either fairly or unfairly, people are asking about the plaintiff's behavior, how that happened, whether they did something wrong. And so the district court holds him in contempt, in criminal contempt.
Initially civil contempt, and then it becomes criminal contempt.
Yeah. And then tells the U.S. Attorney's Office to prosecute him. And they say, no, thank you. We've decided it's not in our interests to bring a criminal prosecution for criminal contempt. At which point the district court decides not to take no for an answer.
Yeah. They're like, okay, well, executive branch doesn't want to do it. Let me pull the different move, which is appoint my own prosecutors. Well, are they the court's own prosecutors?
The court appoints somebody to litigate the contempt proceeding and then sentence.
Special prosecutors.
Sentences Danziger to 6 months in prison, right?
Yep.
And the question is, can they do that?
Yeah. And this is a weird one. This is something that it doesn't happen super often. And Justice Gorsuch writes this dissent from denial, joined by Justice Kavanaugh. So, you know, suggests some real meaningful interest in the case along the kind of Trump justice axis in the court that comes in pretty hot, I would say. Scorching would be too strong, but really arguing that this is wrong, that this violates, what happened here violates the separation of powers. Also, interestingly, the way he kind of summarizes the facts, he's very uncharitable to Chevron. I mean, uncharitable is the wrong word. He doesn't seem super sympathetic to Chevron's conduct. His opinion is not really about the merits in the case, but I thought that was interesting.
He does put in allegedly in the first sentence, Texaco allegedly polluted rainforests and rivers in South America.
Yeah, but then he kind of seems to be criticizing them for asking for the litigation to be transferred to Ecuador, and then later Chevron came to regret that move.
Right. So just also to add to the kind of funny lineup. So here we have Danziger, a plaintiff's lawyer, generally lionized by the left and represented by Steve Vladek, quite liberal law professor, who go to the Second Circuit, and the one judge who agrees with them is Judge Stephen Menasche, a Trump-appointed judge in the Second Circuit. And then they seek cert, and it's Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh are the most interested in hearing this issue. So the lineup of the parties versus the judges doesn't necessarily match the standard political story.
Yeah, although on the other side in the Second Circuit case is Judge Park, right, who's also a Trump appointee.
Mm-hmm, that's true. And obviously there are some Trump appointees not voting to grant cert in this case, too.
Yeah, well, just one.
Well, actually, I guess we don't know. you know, maybe she would.
Yeah,
fair. So how do you think about this? This is kind of like a great con law one issue spotter, right? So who are these special prosecutors? Because part of what's both rich about the case, but also maybe shows you why the court's reluctant to get into it, is there are so many choices.
Yeah.
So at various points in the litigation, various people think there are at least four categories, right? So maybe these special prosecutors are officers of the United States who have to be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, in which case definitely unconstitutional. Maybe they are so-called inferior officers.
An officer of the United States we'd call like a principal officer, right?
A principal officer. Yeah. Sure. Well, yeah. Okay. Maybe they're so-called inferior officers whose appointment can be vested in the president alone, in the heads of departments, or in the courts of law. And if we're on that branch, maybe this counted as a courts of law appointment, although doing that would require a statute, and there's a dispute whether there's a statute in this case.
Yeah.
Or maybe we think that courts of law can only appoint people who exercise judicial power, like clerks, and can't cross-appoint people in the executive branch, like prosecutors. But maybe we think this is, which one is this? Or maybe this person's not an officer of the United States at all, which I think is one of the Department of Justice's theory. Maybe they're just a sort of limited purpose
employees, or, you know.
Yeah.
In which case, they can kind of do whatever. I mean, there wouldn't be necessarily appointments clause limitations on right. who can appoint them.
And I'll just say, to me, none of those are obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, but also none of them are obviously wrong to me. I mean, Justice Christensen sort of works through some of those options to say, you can't think of them as being appointed by the courts pursuant to law because they are appointed under the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 42, which is not a law, it's a rule. But of course, the rule sort of has the force of law because of a statute, but the statute says that the rules aren't supposed to change people's rights, and it like dives straight into these super hard, kind of eerie rulemaking questions. That's one way to go. I think there's something to the suggestion that they're not officers at all. So that there is this sort of traditional category of people who have a kind of a limited term appointment. Like if a government agency just like hires a lawyer to do a little bit of work for them on some case, they don't do that very often because they usually represent the Department of Justice. But if they did for some reason, that doesn't necessarily convert that person into an officer who needs to be appointed somehow.
Yeah. It sort of depends. It seems like it should depend like also on what stuff they're doing, mm-hmm. right? Like you wouldn't want to say that like they can just have like a private lawyer who like basically does what the attorney general does, but like rotates every 6 months or something between different law firms.
I mean, I think at the founding, you know, there were people like privateers and military contractors who did like very important stuff, but on a very limited contract basis. And the thought was that made the difference. Vladek's brief says, even though it's true, this is a one-time thing that doesn't count here because the idea of those kinds of limited appointments is like, if the person went away, the task would go away too.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you know, if this special prosecutor had like resigned in the middle, we would have a successor in office or something. I don't know if that's right. I don't know what I think about the Erie problem. It's just some of this case rests on an interpretation of a case called Morrison versus Olson, where the Supreme Court upheld the independent counsel, the independent counsel statute later used by Ken Starr as an inferior officer who could be appointed by the courts.
The Scalia dissent in which, don't they like chant this at FedSoc? That's a thing that's literally a thing that happened, right?
Are you serious?
Something I read somewhere that there was like one of the FedSoc conventions where like there was like this kind of like live reading of the key lines from that opinion or something. And everybody was like, you know, chanting along.
It sounds like the myth about the Cravath lawyer's funeral where all the Cravath lawyers show up and, you know, chant the dead, the firm lives. I've been to a lot of FedSoc meetings. There's never been a chanting of Morrison versus Olson, although I would totally go to one.
Would you chant or just watch?
I would lead. As long as we have to include like Mistretta dissent as well.
It's a very well-written opinion.
It's both a well-written opinion and then it has this feature of many people feel like it was vindicated by events because Justice Scalia warned about the possible abuse of this statute and its incursions on executive power. And then Ken Starr's prosecution team seemed to make all Justice Scalia's fears come true. And then when the act was up to be, you know, reenacted, everybody in Congress is like, let's not reenact this and not do this again. So some people have suggested that in a way Scalia's dissent in Morrison versus Olson is like better law than the majority.
Yeah.
Even though it's not a thing the Supreme Court's ever said. Although I think they don't cite it very often.
Yeah. I mean, but it's interesting though, because I feel like some people might have changed their view about that. Like in the Trump era, people may be sort of saying,
yeah, well, we like independent counsels again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although the independent counsels under Trump were not, you know, what was interesting is they showed also how much an independent counsel can accomplish even without a statute like this, because the statute elapsed and the independent counsel could in principle be fired at will by the executive branch.
Yeah, the special prosecutor. They don't still call them independent counsel.
Special prosecutor, sorry. Yeah. Not independent, but special.
Yeah.
And yet still, Trump couldn't bring himself to get the independent counsel fired. Special counsel fired. So this is one of those things, on the one hand, I'm like, how could the court not want to dive into this? But on the other hand, sometimes I feel like when it's just not at all clear what the path is, like even what's the right to think about this or what are the questions, sometimes the court's not super eager to dive into that as the vehicle.
Yeah.
Other thing I noticed in trying to figure out what's going on is there then also do seem to be a bunch of like questions about waiver. So the Second Circuit said that some of these issues had not been raised in the district court and therefore decided them on plain error. But then the cert petition said that that was wrong, and B, the SG waived the plain error argument because the SG's theory of the case is different than the Second Circuit's of the case. So not only are there like four different theories floating around in the case, but I couldn't even get my head around which ones were in the case and what posture, which is sort of a shame.
Yeah. And so just looking, I found it helpful to look back to the Second Circuit decision. And there, the court says, they are officers under the Appointments Clause, but inferior officers. But they're also supervised by the Attorney General, who can, I guess, remove them, and that it was okay for them to be appointed as they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Justice Gorsuch thinks that's real wrong.
Yeah. So he thinks that it can't be that a rule of civil procedure is enough to authorize courts to appoint executive officers.
Yeah.
Both constitutionally and as a matter of the Rules Enabling Act.
Yeah. Which is, you know, which is not crazy. What did you think about that? Were you persuaded by that?
I think it's not crazy. But first of all, I think you would. So on the constitutional side, you would have to overturn Morrison versus Olson, I think. A little confused about that, but Morrison versus Olson does say you can have courts appoint executive prosecutors, and so you'd have to overrule it, right? And boy, I mean, I still don't understand how the rules of civil procedure work. Maybe other people do, but what Justice Gorsuch says about the rules of civil procedure not counting as by law might be right.
How do you know? I feel like that's an issue that would be right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, no, you would think.
But I mean, his problem is not just the problem about were they appointed the right way. I mean, I think, as I understand, he really doesn't think that judges should be able to appoint prosecutors at all, right?
That's just it, right. Yeah. So that's Morrison versus Olson. Morrison versus Olson says judges can appoint prosecutors.
Yeah.
Now, Akhil Amar taught me in constitutional law that was definitely wrong. And Akhil Amar and Justice Gorsuch both think it's definitely wrong. Maybe it's definitely wrong. But that's one, to be clear, he's asking for them to overturn a major Supreme Court precedent. And then then that leads us to the backup argument. Again, maybe it is wrong, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
My memory is also that an early draft of the Judiciary Act did authorize the Supreme Court to appoint U.S. attorneys or interim U.S. attorneys. Not the final draft, but that was like on the table. And this is often, you know, and then people try to figure out, did they take that out?
Wouldn't those be principal officers of the United States, like a U.S. attorney?
I don't know. Depends on how much authority they have. I mean,
yeah. They have a lot of authority.
Yeah. I think the Supreme Court may never have squarely held that lower court judges are principal officers, although it has a footnote where it notes that everybody's always assumed that they are.
Yeah.
But you can imagine the theory in which the Supreme Court could appoint lower court judges.
Would they have life tenure still?
Yeah. No, they'd still have to have life tenure, but maybe they could be,
that'd be wild,
internally appointed.
Yeah.
Like Israel.
Well, not for long, right?
Well, too soon to tell.
Yeah, there's this big battle in Israel where the prime minister is trying to reform the judiciary. I don't have the comparative expertise to know something about it, but it is interesting to be watching what's going on there in light of the debate that, you know, I've been a participant in about court reform in the United States.
Yes.
So maybe if we have listeners who are, you know, experts in Israeli law and politics, they can teach us something.
They're trying to teach me something all the time.
I just can't learn. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not saying Justice Gorsuch is wrong, but I'm saying there's a lot going on here.
I guess it's complicated. Like if you just read, I just read his thing and hadn't really thought about this case, and I was like, oh, it's pretty persuasive. Like how does a court get to do this and like, you know, have people who are prosecuting people? But then you look at the Second Circuit opinion, it's definitely a little bit messier. But it is troubling, like atmospherically at least, that you go to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney says, no thanks, we don't want to prosecute. And then the court can appoint other people, kind of overturn that exercise of prosecutorial discretion and say, well, I'm hiring you because I want you to prosecute the case and not decline to prosecute the case.
On the other hand, it's troubling to think that a federal court can issue a binding order, and whether that order gets enforced depends on whether the executive branch wants it to. Like, one of the courts don't have a lot of powers. One of the powers they have is the power to issue binding judgments, binding orders.
The contempt order.
Yeah. So, I mean, this comes up in the context of a contempt order, but I've thought about it and written about it in the context of, like, a final judgment of of unconstitutionality. And so this is one thing that also makes me sympathetic to one of the other theories is, you know, so this comes up in the Civil War when there are possible habeas corpus proceedings that maybe the executive branch is ignoring, and, you know, there are various debates whether the executive branch has to comply with the judicial order. And one of the phrases I remember, I think it's Lincoln's Attorney General Bates, uses in debating this and talking about some of the powers of the courts, and because he's kind of trying to concede the courts do have a lot of power, but it doesn't apply here. And he says, well, of course, everybody knows that the courts can call out the entire power of the country to enforce their judgments. They can they can command a posse. And then there's some references to, like, how it used to be if a court issued an order and it wasn't followed, the court itself could, like, go to the community and demand that the posse enforce the judgment. And that's a little bit of what it's doing here.
Yeah, but except for very different.
Well, anyway, I never managed to write the paper about the posse power, and it was one of those things that's going to make me sound kind of too weirdly.
And how does criminal contempt work? I mean, the judge sort of says you're in contempt, and then it has to go be prosecuted. Isn't there some things for, like, inherent contempt where the judge can just, like, immediately order someone to prison for, like, a contempt that occurs, like, in the judge's presence?
I think so, but isn't that still criminal contempt?
Yeah, but I thought that, does it always have to be run through a prosecution, or are there some times when the judge can just, like, enter an order saying, like, you're in jail now?
I think if it happens, yeah, I think you're right that if it happens in the judge's presence, like, and maybe there's some other.
If someone is just, like, you know, screaming obscenities at the judge can just say.
Yeah. You know. And if that doesn't require an executive branch, like, we don't ask separation of powers questions about that.
Yeah. But that could just be, you know, that could be something that we think is within the judicial power. And here, I mean, isn't there agreement that this is executive power that's being exercised?
There's agreement by I think all of the parties at this stage of the litigation agree about that. But I'm not sure everybody in this case agrees about, like, I'm not sure everybody to have waited on this litigation at any point agrees about that. And it's not obviously correct.
Yeah. But if it's not correct, then the Attorney General shouldn't have a role at all with respect to these special prosecutors, right? If it's judicial power that they're exercising.
Yes, sure. Or, I mean, you could invite these Attorney General's view as a matter of, And maybe the president could still pardon you, I guess.
I don't know.
Still be an offense against the United States, I think.
Yeah.
That's what I like about this is just a lot of layers and a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, and I can see why they maybe didn't want to wade into it. It would have been great to see it granted, because I would love to see, you know, 60 pages of Supreme Court level briefing exploring all the different wrinkles.
Yeah, me too.
But we are not going to get that.
There's a lot of stuff. They have a lot of room in their docket, so they could spend it on this.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is a very unusual situation. And so they might have just decided, like, this doesn't come up that often. Kind of interesting, super, super messy and complicated, you know, let's just let it go.
Yeah, it could be. There was a case the court granted a while ago, maybe the term I clerked, sort of about this, about private prosecutors that arose out of D.C.
Yeah, that ended up, I think, dismissed my year.
Yeah. Cited in the Chief Justice, and I think four justices wrote a dissent from the dig, which is rare. And that opinion, so those concerns are also cited in the cert papers.
Yeah.
You know, and that one too, you could say, look, how often does this happen? It involves, you know, complicated statutes and restraining orders and special issues about federal law confronted in D.C. But then there's a previous case, Young, they're all citing here. It comes up often enough that we've got some weird precedents about it.
Yeah. And it is interesting that you have Gorsuch, you have Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
They're not able to peel off Thomas and Barrett. At least they're not able to peel off both of them. Because then you would have had four votes to grant.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah, too bad.
In terms of other stuff to talk about, in theory...
There were some merits opinions.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about... I kind of just declined to let these go. Luna Perez versus Sturgis Public Schools, which is about the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It's just not... It's not interesting.
Interesting that Justice Gorsuch writes an opinion for the little guy.
He likes some little guys, right?
Yeah, I know.
And then we have, I guess, like, I think...
I just wanted to get credit for it.
That's kind of a theme in his opinions, don't you think? This is the little guy being crushed, or someone's trying to crush the little guy. Unless it's the frozen trucker.
a little guy with a technical legal argument on his side. You've got Justice Gorsuch. I mean, I guess Donziger is kind of a big guy, but
big guy in jail for 6 months.
Yeah.
The other one, Wilkins versus United States, is an opinion about the Quiet Title Act, which is something, some act, I never heard of this, where you can go file some suit to challenge the United States' claimed interest in real property. And it has this 12-year time limit.
I'm sorry. Dan, are you serious? You've never heard of the Quiet Title Act?
I've heard of Quiet Title Actions, but, I'd never really thought about
the federal Quiet Title Act?
I don't know. When has this come up in my life? I've never needed to, resolve, federal law property rights issues.
I clerked in the 10th Circuit, and the Quiet Title Act came up all the time.
Okay. I'll just say that. I mean, because you had, cattle ranches and stuff and easements and things like that.
You have a complicated overlay of federal and state and county and private claims.
I mean, I've probably heard about it. It's just never something I've thought about. So it has this 12-year time limit. There's this long-running series of cases about whether various kinds of time limits for filing actions are jurisdictional, in which case they're automatic. Nobody can do anything about it. If you're a day late, you lose, you're screwed, or non-jurisdictional, in which the case they might be, they could be waivable, lots of other things that consequences that flow from that.
Yeah.
And, some are yes, some no. This one is not jurisdictional.
Right. Well, it's not just some are yes, some are no. It's almost always they're no.
Yeah, although the time limit for filing an appeal, notice of appeal is...
Yes, but about 15 years ago, the Supreme Court sort of started on the warpath on these. There were a bunch of time limits and limits that courts had called jurisdictional, and Justice Ginsburg sort of started a cleanup campaign to go through a bunch of them and say, no, it's not jurisdiction in the technical sense.
And to be clear about what that phrase even meant.
Yeah. And every once in a while, there's one that is or where she loses about whether it is, the time limit for filing an appeal and a couple more. But I think if you take, I'm just estimating, if you take the 15 to 20 cases like this, I think 13 to 18 of them are non-jurisdictional.
Yeah, fair enough. Here we have an opinion by Justice Sotomayor, 6-3. She's joined by Kagan, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson. Dissent by Justice Thomas, joined by the Chief and Alito. The dispute is not super interesting. A huge amount of it is just about how clearly did our prior precedent resolve this question? Does the precedent say it's jurisdictional and we have to follow that? I don't have a ton to say about it.
Justice Thomas has an argument that's not exactly presidential. It's just the United States has sovereign immunity.
Yeah.
The Quiet Title Act is a waiver of sovereign immunity. Therefore, the Quiet Title Act is jurisdictional. Now, I think that's not the way the court thinks of it now.
Well, clearly not.
And also puzzling because sovereign immunity as jurisdictional is also confusing because sovereign immunity is waivable and jurisdiction is not waivable.
Yeah.
And sovereign immunity arguments can even sometimes be waived, not just by statute, but, in litigation. So I have questions about this. But this opinion is by Justice Sotomayor. This might be one of the best Justice Sotomayor opinions I've ever read.
Until next week when you discover some fatal jurisdictional flaw in the jurisdictional analysis.
I'm not saying anything in Cruz was fatal. I'm just saying I don't understand what's going on.
You think it was wrong. You think it was grievously wrong.
I think something is missing. Maybe put it that way. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying you can't have an opinion that goes, well, we have jurisdiction. Okay, we're done. I mean, I think there's nothing that stops a court from doing that.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of an advisor opinion, but it's probably okay. It's just a really weird opinion to write.
Yeah, but it seems to rest on some kind of incorrect premise about the way the law works, if they write that. And they seem to think it has some, because if that's the only thing you were going to conclude, and sorry, this is taking us back to Cruz, wouldn't the result just be affirm? It's we have jurisdiction to resolve the issue. We're not doing so. Affirm. Right?
Yes. The part where you vacate and remand for consideration of the fact that we have jurisdiction. Okay. It doesn't have to be wrong. So at least on my view of vertical precedent, a lower court has more obligation to follow higher court precedent if the higher court has jurisdiction than it does if the higher court doesn't have jurisdiction. That part of the reason lower courts have to follow Supreme Court precedent is because Supreme Court has jurisdiction. So I could at least imagine some cases where knowing there was appellate jurisdiction would affect how the lower court should decide the case. I'm not saying the court was going there, but...
Yeah. Okay, well, that took us back to Cruz. I don't really have anything else to say about Wilkins.
Yeah.
And I think that might take us to the end. This is a good time to break.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for listening. Please rate and review the show on your podcast app of choice, such as the Apple podcast app. That does help new listeners discover the show, but also anything direct you can do to help new listeners discover the show would be appreciated. Send it to people. Our listenership has kind of steadily grown, but my sense is that there's still probably a lot of people in the universe who haven't heard of the show and might benefit from it. I don't think that we're ever going to get to millions of listeners with our quirky jurisdictional conversations, but there's some people out there. Go to our website, dividedargument.com. We put transcripts of the episodes up relatively soon after they air, store.dividedargument.com. We do have some merchandise. You have one of the t-shirts, Will, right?
I do. I wore it last time I saw you.
I know. It was great. I was pleased that you were kind of fanboying for me, right?
I had this unfortunate, embarrassing thing happen at the gym the other day. I was wearing the shirt and somebody saw it and saw the motto on the back, you know, unscheduled, unpredictable, and said, oh, that's cool, man. Unscheduled, unpredictable. That's I want that to be my motto in life. You know, where'd you get that? And then I had to say, well, you know, actually, it's the motto of my own podcast.
And then did that kind of deflate the conversation?
No. They might be listening now.
Okay. Shoot us an email, pod@dividedargument.com. I'm not great about responding to those, but we do read them and sometimes incorporate any feedback or thoughts. Leave us a voicemail, 314-649-3790.
Thanks to the Constitutional Law Institute for sponsoring all of our endeavors. Thanks to the court for keeping up a steady diet of obscure jurisdictional problems for us to tangle with.
And if you don't hear from us for a while, it's because we're in prison, because we've been held in criminal contempt by a federal court.
But judicial power or executive power?
Well, you'll find out in 6 months when we get out.